The Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, El Niño. The warming of the South Pacific Ocean is occurring faster and earlier than at any time since 1982. It will affect our weather. We talk green about seafood and your eating habits. Can we eat fish without being poisoned or destroying the world's fish stocks? And in the Earth calendar, beluga whales have just donned shiny new white suits in Alaska. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. On occasion, the surface temperature of the South Pacific Ocean increases substantially. When this happens, it affects the weather here in the United States and all over the world. When the seawater warms, an effect is created called an El Niño. Normally, this phenomenon begins in the fall and the winter, but right now, an El Niño is forming, which is stronger and earlier than any since 1982. Dr. Jerry Bell is at the Climate Prediction Center of the National Weather Service, and he studies the El Niño phenomenon.
Generally, during an El Niño, we see abnormally warm waters in the tropical Pacific extending from the dateline to the South American coast, which is approximately one quarter of the globe in terms of distance,
so,
if you will.
Now take us through the process. You have this warming that occurs.
Yes.
You call it an El Niño.
Yes.
And what happens both to the atmosphere and then to the climate?
Well, the next thing that happens is that tropical thunderstorm activity gets disrupted. Thunderstorms like warm, just like, you know, if you're in the Midwest or somewhere, a hot, muggy day, you fire up thunderstorms. Well, it's the same kind of thing in the tropics. You get very, very deep and extensive thunderstorm activity where there's warm ocean waters. The El Niño basically reflects a change in where the waters are warmest. Therefore, we have a change in where the tropical thunderstorm activity is. Normally, Indonesia has heavy thunderstorm activity. During an El Niño, it's substantially reduced, and that activity has shifted well eastward. That's the direct effect of the El Niño on the atmosphere, and that effect is in the tropics. But what happens now is that the jet stream, which ultimately drives our weather patterns, is partly structured the way it is because of this tropical thunderstorm activity. Therefore, by altering the thunderstorm activity, you alter the jet stream. By altering the jet stream, you then alter the global weather patterns because they are driven by the jet stream.
Bell says the impacts are then felt here.
The El Niño affects the entire global circulation. Over the United States, the impacts tend to be most pronounced in the winter and spring, and that's because that's when the El Niños tend to be strongest. Now we're in an event now where it's particularly strong right now, but that isn't typical. Normally during the wintertime in the U.S., you tend to see warmer than normal temperatures throughout southern Alaska, western Canada, cooler and wetter than normal conditions across the southern tier of the United States. So it would be heavier wintertime rainfall and so on down in the southeast and Gulf Coast states. California, if they're going to have heavy rainfall or very heavy, abnormally heavy rainfall, that tends to be during an El Niño. The northern tier of the U.S. oftentimes will be warmer than normal, although it's there's a little bit of variability from one event to the next.
No.
So much of the North America is really influenced by the El Niño.
Dr. Bell says that El Niño generally diminishes the hurricane season in the Atlantic, although this year it'll be hard to predict because of the early formation of El Niño. El Niños have primary impact on the entire southern half of the globe, but he says long-range weather forecasting all over is facilitated during the 12 to 18 months that an El Niño lasts.
We like when there's an El Niño because it tends to set up preferred circulation patterns, so we get a better handle It's basically a forcing mechanism to force certain circulation patterns and jet stream patterns and storm tracks and rainfall and temperature and so on. So our long-range predictive skill improves substantially during an El Nino.
Long-range weather forecasting plays an important role in many endeavors, such as managing dams for mitigation of floods or storing water for droughts. But Bell says the presence of an El Nino can have a huge impact if you're thinking about sailing your yacht from South America to Australia or some other Pacific island. While prevailing winds blow you westward across the Pacific, during an El Nino, the winds blow in an opposite direction, which might prevent you from even getting started. Scientists are now collecting reams of data about El Ninos from buoys in the Pacific. They relay temperature, winds, and atmospheric pressure on a constant basis via satellite. Recognizing the El Nino phenomenon, which has been recurring regularly for hundreds of thousands of years, is very new to science. What causes it is not known. Again, Jerry Bell.
There was a fellow named Sir Gilbert Walker in the early 1900s who recognized some patterns of rainfall over South America with changes in the ocean temperatures, and he had bits and pieces of the what's now become known as the El Nino. But it really wasn't until the late 60s, a fellow named Bjerknes in 69 put together a lot of the ocean, oceanic and atmospheric features into a coherent description of the El Nino phenomenon, the whole coupled ocean atmosphere description. He was the first one to really pin that down. And then things were, there's so much data and it's so complicated that it really awaited substantive study, really awaited some high-speed computers. And it turns out that those started coming online about the time of the major 82-83 El Nino.
Bell says one thing that's clear to him is that underwater volcanoes and any global warming due to greenhouse gas emissions are not causes of El Niños. Monthly status reports and El Niño forecasts are published on the web through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Their most recent forecast says that we'll see wetter, cooler weather for the southern half of the United States from November through March, and the northern part of the country, from Washington State east to the western Great Lakes, will experience warmer than normal temperatures. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today, we're talking about seafood and fish and what you can eat and what you should stay away from. Many of the world's fisheries are overfished, and fish is not reproducing as it might, since much of our habitat for fish is being destroyed, whether it be salmon streams in Alaska or wetlands on the Gulf Coast of the United States. Also, within the last week, the Environmental Protection Agency has put out a record number of fish advisories cautioning fishers not to eat fish which they catch from various streams and water bodies as a result of the chemical contaminants which the fish store in their bodies. So we want to hear from you. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and I have two guests with me. One is Jack Sobel. He's the director of the Ecosystem Protection Program at the Center for Marine Conservation, which is an environmental organization in Washington, D.C., and he leads the center's research and advocacy efforts to develop and strengthen marine protected areas. Also with me is Dr. Amy Kyle. She's a research scientist in environmental health policy at the School of Public Health at the University of California in Berkeley. And she's now working as a Schweitzer Environmental Leadership Fellow at the Natural Resources Defense Council in San Francisco, where she's completing a national review of chemical contaminants in fish. So, Jack, let me start with you. If I go to the market and want to buy some fish, is there anything I can buy without encouraging the overfishing, which is eliminating fish stocks around the world?
Well, certainly anything that you eat is going to lead to harvest. However, some species are more vulnerable to overexploitation, and some species have already been more overharvested than others. Now, keeping track for an individual, it is difficult sometimes to keep track of all the things out there in the marketplace. Some of the things that we can give some guidance on certain species that people should be concerned and careful about. Certainly, organisms like sharks, which have life histories that make them very vulnerable, are particularly prone to overexploitation. And so just as a general guiding rule, organisms
stay
like
away
that,
from shark fin soup, then.
You need to be careful about. There's also organisms like our reef fish, which similarly, many of those have life histories that make them prone to overexploitation.
And again, for someone who walks into a fish market, how do they know what's a reef fish?
Fish such as groupers and snappers. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean we're not suggesting that we don't eat those fish or that we don't stop exploitation. But they are things, they are fish that are sensitive to overexploitation, and that we should be careful both in our consuming habits and also as concerned consumers and citizens should be contacting management agencies and ensuring proper management plans.
Well, let's get back to that. But Amy Kyle, when I go and buy a fish, or for those of us that are fisher people, catch one, how do I know that it's not contaminated with toxic chemicals like PCBs and the like?
Well, it's a good question, and it's interesting that Jack is talking about sharks, because sharks are one of two species of commercial fish for which the Federal Food and Drug Administration has issued a warning to people, particularly women who are pregnant or may become pregnant, advising them to limit their consumption of shark and also of swordfish, because those are big fish that eat at the top of the food chain and tend to become contaminated with mercury. So
they get the mercury that is in everything that was in everything that everybody else ate before they ate it.
Exactly, because it persists in their bodies for quite a while, as it will then in ours if we eat them. So shark and swordfish are the two species where we have an official warning from the federal government that these, especially, as I say, for women, because it's developing fetuses and small children who are most vulnerable to the effects of mercury, that we might want to stay away from. Now, other big fish like that, like tuna, for example, also tend to accumulate mercury, so that might be one that, again, if you were concerned about that, you might want to keep your consumption of that limited. Beyond that, it's hard to know because it depends on where the fish comes from. Fish from more contaminated areas tend to be more contaminated. And the harsh reality is that it's hard to find that out. So about the best you can do in the market is to see if you can find out where the fish came from and whether it came from someplace that sounds like it might be contaminated.
Jack, we hear so much about overconsumption and overfishing. Will my grandchildren be able to eat ocean-caught fish, or is this going to be a thing of the past because we've fished them all out?
I don't have a crystal ball, and I think that there will probably continue to be ocean fishing, and your grandchildren will probably continue to eat ocean-caught fish. However, they will be reduced in numbers from what they may be reduced in numbers from what they are today. And the diversity of what's out there is certainly being reduced currently. And so the options, if we don't manage our resource better than we are currently managing it, the options for what they can eat and what fishermen can continue to catch and make money on will likely be reduced.
Before we go to the phones, I have an email message which came to us, and it's from Louise in Dallas. And she says, I've heard more and more fish on the market are being supplied from fish farms. Can't the farms ensure that we'll have an adequate supply in the future?
Well, from our perspective, aquaculture is not a panacea for the problems of overfishing. And although they can supply some of the market demand, they can't supply all of it. And in many cases, aquaculture is also not without its own environmental risks. There have been problems, for instance, with salmon aquaculture and the introduction of disease organisms and the escape of exotic species to areas where they're not native. There's also been problems with shrimp aquaculture in terms of destruction of mangrove and other habitats and pollution associated with that and habitat degradation. So
none of it is a very happy picture, as I hear you both speak. Let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And Eric from Wisconsin. You're talking green on the Environment Show. Welcome. Eric, are you there?
Yes, Peter. Hi.
Okay. You're talking green on the Environment Show. I understand you have a question or a comment on
fisheries. I got a question involving, you know, these chemicals that we've got going into the lakes as far as the consumption advisory is concerned. Do they consider total risk from all the chemicals that are going into these fish? Where are these chemicals coming from, basically, and how is this best prevented? Rather than having to give up eating fish, what can we do to stop the advisories from happening?
That's a good question. Amy, what do you think?
No, I think that is the question, is that we can't just keep warning people. We need to actually solve this problem. And we need to just say no now to continuing to release these persistent toxic substances in the environment. But with regard to this question, in the Great Lakes states, the contaminants come both from air deposition and also from local both so-called point sources, such as wastewater discharges, and also from non-point sources, such as runoff from the ground itself. They come from all three of those types of sources. And some of the contaminants in fish also get into the sediments and then are re-released to fish.
But so Eric has raised a question about looking at the total impact. And I presume by that, Eric, you're talking about what happens when a combination of these chemicals get into the fish and then into you.
Right. You know, they list these advisories for one chemical at a time. And I'm just wondering what the risk is from all the chemicals that are in the fish.
The whole chemical stew. Amy, yeah. Does that get considered when they do the advisories or not?
Not really. People don't really know how to do that very well. And it's an important question as well, because also you have other sources of some of these contaminants besides just what's in the fish. So when you think about you yourself, you know, you may be catching a risk, say, for dioxin from fish as well as from meat as well as from milk. And so thinking about that holistically is an important challenge for public policy.
And I guess
policy.
The question, Eric, if you're in the Great Lakes region, is does the chemical mix in one lake give a separate bouquet, if you like, to the taste of the fish than the chemicals in another lake? Have you had any experience on whether all these things have different tastes?
Well, no, not really, because it doesn't seem that many of these things are things that you can taste in the fish.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. And I'd like to raise with you, Jack, the whole question of overfishing.
Okay.
We have this situation in which nations have supported the creation of fishing fleets. Everybody's out there, more and more hardware, fancy and faster equipment, chasing fewer and fewer fish. This has got to end in disaster, doesn't it?
Well, certainly. I mean, you raise the issue of subsidies to fishing fleets, and that's certainly a big problem. I mean, we spend more money on subsidizing our fleet than the value of the catch that they make. And certainly, you know, from a strictly economic point of view, let alone a conservation point of view, that's something that doesn't make sense. We are making some progress in terms of there's been the passage of international treaty that's trying to get a handle on international fisheries. And last year, the Center for Marine Conservation and others were very successful in reauthorizing the Magnuson Fisheries Conservation Act, which certainly provides a framework for protecting our domestic fisheries.
And again, for people who are not familiar with that, that provides that councils, separate councils up and down the coastlines, will establish catch limits for certain kinds of fish.
That is correct, and some of the new aspects of the reauthorization, which was one of the few stronger pieces of conservation legislation that came out of that Congress, is that it starts to also get at the issues of protecting essential fish habitat, which we all know habitat is important for maintaining these fisheries, in addition to setting catch limits and protecting stocks that way. And the other element that's very important is some measures in terms of bycatch, reducing bycatch, which is the unintentional
take. And that's the stuff that you catch when you were after something else.
That's correct. And it can either be from harvesting species that you're not targeting, which is a big problem. It can also be from catching undersized fish, which you then have to return to the ocean because you're not allowed to catch them. And in both cases, it's basically a wasteful process, and anything that we can do to reduce or eliminate that bycatch will be valuable to fishermen in the long run and to consumers as well as from a conservation perspective.
In our short time that's left, can either of you give our listeners any guidelines as to what they can do to make sure that they're eating the right thing?
Well, I would say that, first of all, very clearly, I'm a fish eater. I like eating fish. I'm not opposed to catching a fish. And I think the best thing that a consumer can do is be educated both about the health risks that are associated with particular species and also with the conservation concerns of what's being caught.
Amy Kyle, on the health side, what is really safe, if anything?
Well, like Jack said, it varies a lot depending on where you are, and it is good to eat fish. Fish is a healthy sort of food, so I don't discourage people from eating fish, but I think it's important to make sure that if you're eating a lot of fish from one area, particularly, which usually happens with people who catch their own, that you check and make sure that fish is not contaminated.
Okay.
And then if you're eating fish in the market, you eat a variety of different kinds.
Well, thank you. I'm afraid our time is up. My guests have been Jack Sobel from the Center for Marine Conservation and Amy Kyle from the School of Public Health at the University of California in Berkeley. We've been talking green. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We want to hear from you. I'm your host, Peter Burley. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we broadcast, beluga whales found in the coastal waters of Alaska have just changed their clothes. Sometimes reaching 16 feet in length, they are
well-dressed in their new shiny white skins and looking for something to eat.
That is Kathy Frost, marine mammals biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The reason beluga whales are sporting new shiny white skins is they've just finished shedding their old ones, as well as giving birth.
At this time of year, June and July, they come close to shore to capitalize on some of the food resources that show up there, like red salmon in Bristol Bay. They also come to have their calves, and that happens about 4th of July weekend. And then they do something most people don't know about. Belugas molt or shed their skin once a year. And that also happens in late June, early July.
What is the process by which a beluga sheds its skin?
Well, what they seem to do is come into shallow nearshore areas that have nice scratchy bottoms, things like rocks or stones or gravel, and often they look for warm water areas and areas with a little bit of fresh water outflow. And what we think happens is they come in and that fresh water helps the skin slough. They rub on the bottom to rub the old skin off, a lot like your dog rolls outside when it's trying to shed its fur, and then the warm water promotes faster skin growth so the new skin can come in.
So do they scrape it off in chunks, much as we do when we get a sunburn? Is that what it looks like?
It comes off in little long, thin strips, less than a half an inch wide and anything from an inch long to sometimes 2 or 3 inches long. It's simply a replacement of the skin. If you look at a beluga whale in Alaska in May or June, the skin is really quite yellow and worn. There's a lot of little nicks and scratches and pock marks, and the skin looks old and well used. And what happens in June, July is basically a replenishment of that skin. It gets rid of the old beat-up layer and grows a fresh, new, shiny white layer.
And they're nursing their young at the same time this is going on, I guess.
Yep, they sure are. Calving happens in a lot of areas of the state around the end of June and the early part of July. Beluga calves stay with their moms a lot longer than, for example, a seal pup does. Beluga calf may be with its mother up to a couple of years.
Frost says the striking white color is not the only thing that distinguishes the beluga.
Belugas were called sea canaries by the early whalers, and that's because they're so vocal. I think most of us don't think about whales making lots of noise, and belugas do. They chip and chirp and grunt and groan and click and make all sorts of noises, enough so that if you're sitting on the beach near a large group of belugas, there's just a real cacophony of sound.
Frost says management of belugas is a success story. Populations are stable, and they're hunted only by Eskimos for subsistence food. The Eskimos and the marine biologists have taught each other a lot about the beast. So next time you're making small talk and have run out of things to say, ask your friends to name a singer who eats octopus and shrimp and puts on a new white suit each summer. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. Canadian fishermen blockaded a U.S. ferry last week. It was the latest move in a bitter fight between the U.S. and Canada over declining stocks of salmon. Our ear to the ground finds out how Alabamans get rid of used motor oil safely. We go birding with folks who are trying to save the threatened grasshopper sparrow and all of our birds. Author Christopher Manis finds the love affair between animals and humans started long before birders got their binoculars. And Walkin' Jim Stoltz finds the power in the earth in an old Christmas carol which became a union song. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. A full-scale fish war has broken out in the North Pacific. Tensions have been escalating since negotiations between the U.S. and Canada broke off last month. Both sides operate their salmon fisheries based on a treaty which expired earlier this year. Without that agreement, the situation has become a free-for-all. Both countries are overfishing, and many say already depleted fish populations are in danger of crashing. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally has more.
Last week, Canadian fishermen ended a three-day blockade of an Alaskan-bound ferry with 300 passengers on board. Alaska says it will sue for damages and may end the ferry service, an important link between the two countries. Canada claims Alaskans are taking salmon that's rightfully theirs, and British Columbia's premier has threatened to cancel a lease for a U.S. military installation. All this because salmon populations have been declining at the same time the fishing fleet has gotten larger and more sophisticated. A salmon treaty exists between the U.S. and Canada, but it's now expired. It's based on an equivalency principle. That means each country has the right to fish those salmon created within that country's boundaries.
Those fish that originate in U.S. Streams are U.S. property. Those fish that originate in Canadian streams, likewise, are Canadian property. However, these fish migrate widely, and they migrate from Canada into Alaska, and they migrate from the Northwest into British Columbia. So some counting mechanism has to be done in terms of the fishing fleet. Each fleet will catch a certain number of fish from the other country. The equivalency principle in the treaty is that for each fish that the Canadians lose that are harvested in Alaska waters, they should be entitled to a U.S. fish migrating into their waters from the lower 48 in the Pacific Northwest, particularly the Columbia River, produces almost all of the north migrating fish.
Glenn Spain is the Northwest Regional Director for the U.S.-based Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. He says divvying up the multi-million-dollar salmon bounty has become a problem because U.S. rivers, especially the Columbia River in Washington, are only producing 2 to 3% of their original runs of salmon, and he says he knows why.
The problem is the dams. The Pacific Salmon Treaty is becoming more and more inequitable because the fish that are intended to replace the ones that Canadians lose in Alaska are not coming out of the Columbia, and they're not surviving at sea. with the El Nino upcoming and past El Nino events, it's been even worse. It's exacerbated the problem. We have stressed these river systems to the point where they can no longer produce the fish that they need to produce in order to make the treaty work.
There are about 2,700 dams on the Columbia River alone. Spain says they account for up to 95% of all human-caused salmon deaths. Ann Platt McGinn is with the World Watch Institute. She says all parties share the blame for the current situation. And without the treaty, fishermen are over-harvesting salmon, which may have dire consequences for the future.
Right now, there's been a complete breakdown in talks, and so people are going out and fishing without any limits whatsoever. And so in a year where the reports of forecasted stocks have been extremely low, you've got a really dangerous situation where people are basically operating with no law or limits on them. And the meanwhile, the salmon stocks in extreme danger, as they always have been, with forecasts for a worsening situation. So as these tensions rise, chances are that there's going to have to be a breakthrough in with the talks. Otherwise, you know, we can expect a severe crisis.
Canadians claim U.S. fishermen have taken 35 million more salmon than they have since 1985. And just this month, the U.S. State Department admitted U.S. fishermen unintentionally caught 3 to 4 times their allotted amount of sockeye salmon this season. In response to this, Canadian officials are writing a plan to up their catch of salmon. It's called the Canada First Fishing Strategy and would take 1.5 million salmon from U.S. fishermen. But quantifying what is fair for each country is complicated. There are competing statistics from federal, regional, tribal, state, and provincial governments. And Ann Platt McGinn of World Watch says there are too many fishermen out there. It's a mess she blames on the federal government.
In the short term, I think there will be a resolution. But this longer term issue, which is just being faced across the globe, which is the overcapacity of the world's fishing fleets, that has yet to be resolved. And I don't think it will be until governments face up to some of these difficult choices. And by that, I mean that for years they've encouraged people to go out and fish, and they've made loans available and subsidized fleets and whatnot. And now we've got to help these same people who rely on this industry to move on to something else, because there's no way the fishery can support this number of people.
The U.S. and Canada signed the Salmon Treaty 12 years ago. It was written to avoid situations like the one that now exists. And this is just the hottest conflict at the moment. Around the world, fish populations, decimated by habitat destruction and overfishing, have sparked controversy in places like the Baltic and North Seas, Indonesia, Malaysia, India, and other countries. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, recycling by the barrel. Project Rose, recycled oil saves energy. Founder and director of Project Rose, Dr. Gary April, will tell you that what began in 1977 as a program to help conserve energy has evolved into a program that focuses on keeping the environment clean. 1 quart of motor oil at a time. Starting from the ground up, April says Project Rose began with a $5,000 grant from the state of Alabama. He says placing 2 55-gallon drums at a pair of service stations in Tuscaloosa gave do-it-yourself oil changers a place to dispose of their used motor oil.
The biggest problem with do-it-yourself oil changers is the fact that you have to crawl under your car and collect the used oil, and once you collect the used oil, what do you do with it? And most of the time, people will either throw it in the sewer, or they'll dig a hole in their backyard, or they'll go along a fence line around their home, and they'll just pour the oil out into the ground. That is environmentally harmful. It gets into water systems through surface water runoff.
In fact, according to Sherry Powell, also of Project Rose, oil from a single oil change can contaminate 1 million gallons of fresh water, a year's supply for 50 people. And, as Gary April, used oil constitutes the largest single source of oil pollution in our nation's streams and rivers. According to April, educating the public about the hazards of used oil has been key to Project Rose. Today, he says, 20 years after the program began, there are over 400 service stations, auto parts stores, car dealerships, and quick lube facilities throughout Alabama that voluntarily serve as used oil collection sites.
It's that kind of a network to get everybody feeling as though they're contributing that has enabled this program to grow in our state and around the nation.
April, who heads the Chemical Engineering Department at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, where the program operates from, says he's been contacted by 13 foreign countries and every state in the nation about how to start similar programs. Many states, he says, have far exceeded expectations.
Florida, South Carolina, Tennessee have all enacted legislation which provides much larger support for recycling in general, but used oil recycling in particular. And so they are farther advanced in terms of what they're doing in their state with regard to reaching a much broader population.
Supported by the Alabama Department of Economics and Community Affairs, Project Rose has also adopted many spin-off programs, Corporate Rose, Marina Rose, and a farm management program. Used oil doesn't have to be a liability, April says. It's only dirty and can be cleaned and used again and again. He says most of the oil collected from Project Rose goes to a refiner, where it's turned into low-grade fuel oil that can be burned in commercial boilers. The biggest impact Project Rose has had, April says, is empowering people with a common-sense solution to an environmental problem. Over the long haul, collecting one quart of oil at a time has had a tremendous impact, and April hopes this idea will spill over into other areas of recycling. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
I'm Peter Burley, and the Environment Show wants to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Leave a message, and one of our producers will get back to you, or leave a comment that we can put on the air. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can visit us anytime on the Internet where you can hear the Environment Show. It's at www.enn.com/envshow. At daybreak, in farm fields in upstate New York, not far from where the Hudson River turns into the Adirondack Mountains, a team of volunteers is gathering data to nominate this place as an important bird area. The sun is just coming through the mist, dew is dripping from the grass, and white fairy handkerchief spider webs are scattered across the fields. I'm with Jeff Wells, who directs the New York State Important Bird Area Program for the National Audubon Society. Several yards into the field, dim in the mist, are a couple of grasshopper sparrows. He says they're one of the most rapidly declining species in North America. They're little brown birds, about 3.5 inches long and nondescript at a distance. Through binoculars, you see a beautiful mosaic of chestnuts, browns, and tans, bright yellow at the bend of the wing, and a single cream-colored stripe over the top of the head. They sing, "Tuk-zee!" And they're not doing well. Why is that?
They're declining throughout the U.S., mainly because of the loss of their grassland habitats in the east. A lot of it's because we're losing a lot of our farmland habitat to development, or in some cases to abandonment of farms in certain areas. But in places like this area, Washington County of New York State here, the birds are declining mainly because we're losing habitat to development. We're standing at a site here where the land has already been slated for development, and there's signs up and for sale signs here. It's beautiful rolling agricultural land full of meadowlarks and bubbling songs of bobolinks, but there'll be houses up here probably in the next 5 or 10 years all through this area. So that's the main cause of decline. Farmland is really the last haven for most of these grassland birds here in New York State and throughout the Northeast.
In an effort to sustain bird populations, the National Audubon Society and a number of other birding organizations have set up the Important Bird Area Program, or IBA. This is Fred Baumgarten, Audubon's National Coordinator for the effort.
Well, we use a process where volunteers, Audubon members, people in the birding community, as well as land managers and landowners themselves, nominate sites. We then have a review panel made up of some of the top bird experts in the state, review those nominations, make sure that they do qualify according to the criteria we use as an important bird area, and then produce a list and some information on those sites which can be useful in focusing conservation efforts.
And that, of course, is the tough one. Once you've named an important bird area, what happens? So what?
Well, we are focusing on trying to develop conservation plans for those areas. So we put a lot of our energy and emphasis on the follow-up, on the what's next question. And we work in a variety of methods, but first and foremost, it's reaching out to the land managers, if it's a public site, or landowners, if it's a private site, and figuring out what are the issues and how can we cooperatively maintain this area as an important bird area.
Once a nomination is reviewed by a technical committee and the area is designated as an IBA, it's no better protected than it was before. But Bob Budlinger from the New York State Federation of Bird Clubs says IBA designation can be the basis for collaborative efforts between environmentalists, local landowners, and local government.
I think the first and most important part of the Important Bird Areas project is to identify habitat and then let local government and state agencies and private conservation organizations work with landowners, the agricultural community, developers, what have you, in telling them what is needed. And then there are a number of ways to protect habitat, whether it's through conservation easements, agricultural districting, tax relief, acquisition by conservation-based organizations of critical parcels, acquisition by state agencies. There's a wide variety of tools that can be used to give some protection.
150 sites have been nominated so far by citizens, local land trusts, and state and federal agencies. Jeff Wells, New York State coordinator, says the objective is to actually designate about 100. He's optimistic despite a general decline in songbird numbers, which has been going on for several decades.
We've already seen examples of sites that have been designated as IBAs in New York State where we've seen work progressing for conservation, where we've started involving local groups in the efforts there in a way that hadn't happened before, and we've brought sites to the attention of folks in state and federal agencies, so that already we're seeing some results at certain sites where land's being protected and land's managed in a way that's better for the birds.
Unfortunately, we've been seeing a decline in songbird species that seems to have been fairly persistent over the last 30 years. What's the outlook for the future?
Well, I think this kind of proactive approach that we're taking here is the answer to the problem. We have seen declines, particularly in certain species like grassland birds and scrubland birds. And in some other species, we haven't seen severe declines, but we want to be proactive. We want to keep common birds common. And at the same time, we have to look at some species like these grassland birds that have continued to decline and are moving towards endangered and threatened status. But we want to be proactive about these species, and there seems to be a growing groundswell of support for this kind of activity.
The Important Bird Area Program has been launched all over the country. Audubon's Fred Baumgarten says the plan is to designate important bird areas in all 50 states and in Canada and in Mexico. Birders are just one example of the love affair between humans and animals. Author Christopher Manus has chronicled this relationship in his book, Other Creations, Rediscovering the Spirituality of Animals, from Doubleday Books. He traced through the historical record to find the many instances where animals were noted to have magical powers. He found that in virtually all societies, animals provided humans with wisdom and a link to the earth and the heavens. Recently, the Environment Show's Thomas Lally had a chance to speak with him.
I believe we've marginalized animals, and we haven't given much thought about it. Other societies, animals in the past, animals have been central to their religion, central to their economics, etc. I think one of our problems is animals have disappeared. They aren't significant. They don't exist anymore. They're invisible. And I think that happens at risk to our spiritual well-being, because so much of our history, so much of our religion depends on an understanding of animals.
Now, some people might hear that and think, well, you know, I have a tremendous relationship with my dog and my cat, and my daughter is obsessed with her parakeet. So they might say, well, what do you mean we've lost or marginalized our relationship with animals?
Well, yeah, and that's great. I mean, pets are wonderful. I think it's great that people and Americans do like animals. They like pets. Well, what I'm talking about is wild animals, larger animals. Animals used to be central to, well, they're central to every society prior to modern times. I doubt if most people in our society have had real contact with any animal larger than a lap dog, very few people have had contact with a truly wild animal. What they see are images of animals on television and nature films, virtual animals, animals in zoos, but they don't see real animals. And my central theme is that it is our relationship with animals which gave rise to some of the central ideas, the central meaning to our religious existence. That's obvious in history, where animals were central to religion, but it's also history, and it's also important to Western religion, to the Judeo-Christian and the monotheistic religions. The animals are a central metaphor for understanding divinity. So my point is that if we don't have contact with truly wild animals, if we don't meet animals on their terms, and we've completely marginalized them, we've lost the fundamental metaphors for understanding our spiritual ideas.
Now, you've dissected this relationship a bit and broken it down basically into several elements, and some that I don't think a lot of people have ever really considered. Probably the most surprising to me was the link between alphabets and naming animals, and you talk about naming or not naming, well, specifically the bear. Why is that important? What's the link with Yahweh?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. English language, all Germanic languages don't have a name for bear. It's kind of an oxymoron for me to say that because I'm using the word bear, but bear just is a euphemism. It means the brown one. Sometime in the history of Germanic peoples, bears were so important that you weren't allowed to name them. You would use a circumlocution. You would say they're the brown thing over there. A lot of tribes, primal tribes do that. Sacred animals aren't named. In Hebrew tradition, you don't name God. It's not something you ever write. God's name is, you always leave a letter missing in Orthodox Judaism, for instance, even in English. When you spell God, you put G/G/D. You don't write the name of God. It's just too powerful. Same thing happened in the Germanic tradition and another in almost every tradition, where you simply didn't name certain animals because they were too spiritually charged. They were too important. They were taboo.
Thomas Lally speaking with Christopher Manus, author of Other Creations, Rediscovering the Spirituality of Animals, from Doubleday Press. Like many animals, humans like to sing. It helps us as we celebrate the good times or endure the bad ones. Joachim Jim Stoltz's song, Power in the Earth, was originally a Christmas hymn from the 1800s. 100 years later, the song was given new life when unions realized their protest songs would be a lot more popular if they borrowed the melody from songs that everyone knew. So when Joachim Jim Stoltz became active in the environmental movement, he used the same strategy. Here's Power in the Earth from the CD The Vision. It's on Wild Wind Records.
There is power in a band of folks that care when they stand hand in hand. That's a power must be heard throughout this land. For the earth now we must stand. Come on, you folks from all o'er the land, sing out for the earth. Come on, make a stand. No more love canals, no more dying seas. Come on, do your share, sing with me. There is power in the band of us that care when they stand hand in hand. That's the power must be heard throughout this land. For the earth now we must stand.
What gives us the right to soil and destroy? The earth is our home, it isn't a toy. Life has no place in a stripped over land. Come on, do your share and lend a hand.
There is power in the band of folks that care when they stand hand in hand. That's a power must be heard throughout this land. For the earth now we must stand.
Have you had enough destruction and rape of the corporate greed? There ain't no escape. Quality of life means a world that is clean. Come on, help us now, keep it green.
There is power in the band of folks that care when they stand hand in hand. That's a power must be heard throughout this land. For the earth now we must stand.
Power in the Earth by Joachim Jim Stoltz. It's from the CD, The Vision, on Wild Wind Records. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you need a cassette copy so you can predict your own weather and El Nino, call us at 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 395. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer, and Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and the Packard Foundation, as well as Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.
Bye-bye.